to do it. Her desire that I take a different approach to save her time would have cost everyone else even more time. Next, I suggest moving to the first D, delegate, and asking yourself which activities could be done by others. The aim here is not to be lazy or push your real work onto others, but to free up the time so you can actually do your own work, the work only you can do. Delegation can be incredibly empowering. It can be tempting to resist delegation at first, out of fear that the tasks won't be performed right, or of missing out on some things you might enjoy doing. The best way to overcome this temptation is to delegate anyway, starting small if you must, so you can get a taste of it. You will find that it frees up enormous amounts of time, and that, ironically, many of the tasks actually get done better than when you were doing them. Most people rise to the challenge and do great work, and they bring a unique creativity and style that will likely bring great benefit to you. Time-wasting management defects. Some time wasters result not from your own actions, but simply from bad management in your organization or team. Lack of foresight. One such example is the recurrent crisis, which shows that foresight has not been given to anticipate routine problems and correct them. Overstaffing. Another time waster can sometimes ironically be adding staff. Large organizations and large teams are typically a good thing. Great insight is often unlocked from the dynamics of large teams. Nonetheless, in some instances, especially if work on something seems to be going slowly, we might think, oh, we need to add more people to speed this up. If this has to do with an ongoing operation, that is likely the case. But if it is with a project, it might not be the case. Recent project management studies have shown that adding more people to a project sometimes slows down the project because the new people need time to get up to speed. The existing people need to take time away from what they are doing to get the new people up to speed, and the increased communication can divert time and attention. So, in some circumstances at least, adding staff can be another organizational time thief. But again, beware of concluding this too quickly for operational activities, as I think most organizations these days err on the side of being too lean. Bad meetings, resulting from bad organization. The most commonly discussed and felt organizational time waster is bad and excessive meetings. There is no avoiding meetings, and many of us resonate with the idea that meetings are a necessary evil, and that work would be a whole lot better if we just didn't have to go to meetings. But I agree with Patrick Lencioni that this is not a good mindset. Meetings are a critical forum through which those who lead and manage organizations get their work done. For an executive to say, "I'd like my job more if I didn't have to go to any meetings," is like a surgeon saying, "I'd like my job more if I didn't have to operate on people." Or a professional baseball player saying, "I'd love my job if I didn't have to play in these games." In fact, if we hate meetings, it is unlikely that we are able to make good decisions and successfully lead our organizations. For a major purpose of meetings is to extract the collective wisdom from a team, which is essential for making good decisions, staying on the same page, and acting as a real team. There is no substitute for a good meeting, a dynamic, passionate, and focused engagement when it comes to extracting the collective wisdom from a team. Further, meetings deal with compelling issues. They are where presidential cabinets discuss whether to go to war, where governors and their aides debate the merits of raising and lowering taxes, where CEOs and their staffs decide to launch a brand, introduce a product, or close a factory. Meetings done well are crucial and invigorating. Nonetheless, it is still the case that there are too many meetings, and too many of them are bad meetings. These overly abundant meetings, in turn, generate additional work beyond the time in them, including follow-up emails, assigned tasks, and, ironically, more meetings. A solution to this is to make meetings better. First of all, by making sure all meetings are purposeful. You should never have a meeting without defining the purpose, and in most cases, the agenda. But making meetings better is a solution for another place. How do you know when you are having too many meetings? Look at your time log and see how much time you spent in meetings. If it is more than about a fourth of your time, you likely have too many meetings, and they are the result of deficient organization and management practices. Drucker gives us a good principle here. As a rule, meetings should never be allowed to become the main demand on an executive's time. Too many meetings always bespeak poor structure of jobs and the wrong organizational components. Too many meetings signify that work that should be in one job or in one component is spread over several jobs or several components. Malfunctioning information. The last organizational time waster I'll mention is information. Too much information and information that is not presented in a usable form. It is worth spending extra time to make whatever you are creating easy to use for others, whether it's a report, presentation, email, or website. Speak in language your audience will be able to understand. Define any terms only experts would know, and know the form people need your information in. Do not be afraid to prune activities. Even with seeing the activities you can eliminate and delegate, it can be tempting to keep doing them anyway, out of fear that you might cut back too much or eliminate something that you really should keep doing. This is a very understandable concern, and I tend to err on the side of caution here. Nonetheless, I am trying to change my default opinion because I believe Drucker is ultimately right in his observation that if you do cut back too much, that mistake can be speedily corrected. If one prunes too harshly, one usually finds out fast enough. There are ways to delegate that are more and less empowering, and there is a process for delegating that ensures clarity of expectations and builds up the other person. To learn about these principles and practices for effective delegation, see What's Best Next, Chapter 17, The Art of Making Time. Consolidate your time. Once you have pruned the time wasters, you can see how much time you have that is under your control and available for your top priorities, the big tasks that will really make a contribution. How much time will this be? It's helpful to know what is normal, because otherwise you can easily have expectations that are too high and be continually frustrated. A general rule is that the higher you are in an organization, the less time you will have under your control. You will have to give more time to keeping the organization running, focusing internally, than being able to focus your efforts outside, where the results are, making the organization move ahead. Drucker points out that among senior executives, it is rare to have more than 25% of their time truly and fully at their disposal, which equals about 10 to 15 hours per week. This statistic shows how important it is to consolidate your time. Important matters take large and continuous chunks of time, and small driblets are no time at all. Yet here is a word of hope. Even one quarter of the working day, about 2 hours, if consolidated in large time units, is usually enough to get the important things done. But even three quarters of the working day are useless if they are only available as 15 minutes here or there. How do you consolidate your time effectively and give your full attention and focus to your work during that time? In chapters 13 and 14 on deep work, we will learn the principle of working fully when you are working, and resting fully when you are resting. But first, we need to learn how to define our priorities so that we can know what is most important to work on in this concentrated time. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Since work expands to fill the time available, the key is to start with your time, not your tasks. Exercise. Write out an action list for tomorrow. First, determine how much time you have available to do tasks. Then, make estimates for how long each task you would like to do will take. Finally, Refine your list to include only the tasks that are important and fit the time you have. Chapter 12. Set your priorities. Make importance truly work. How to avoid getting stuck in the trap of being busy but not productive. Exclusion as the secret of effectiveness. You need to have a clear sense of where you're going as a company, and then work towards that in a prioritized way. Sundar Pichai, CEO of Google. We saw in the last chapter that many plans for our time fail because we start with trying to plan our tasks rather than first organizing our time. But now that we have eliminated time wasters and consolidated our time into the largest possible chunks, it's time to plan our work and determine what goes into the time we've freed up. Although we may be tempted to try to put everything we want to do into that time, we will soon see that because we have limited time, everything simply will not fit. So we need to choose. We can do only some of the tasks that we want to do. That then brings us to the concept of priorities. We need to make priority decisions among all the tasks available to us. Then, slot those priorities into the time we have consolidated. That is the key to time management. And that means we need to know what our priorities are, how to set them, and what it looks like to truly slot them into our time. What are priorities? Your priorities are not everything you have to do. They are not the same as your responsibilities. They are your chief responsibilities. More specifically, in Peter Drucker's words, a priority is one of the very few major areas where superior performance will produce outstanding results. Something is not a priority if it is not a task, project, or responsibility that will result in high contribution. Why would you focus your efforts on low-value tasks? A priority is a high-value task, and therefore something that takes precedence over other tasks. Priorities are the key to effectiveness. Time management experts consistently make this point. Peter Drucker famously wrote, "If there is any secret of effectiveness, it is concentration. Effective executives do first things first, and they do one thing at a time." And Greg McKeown's recent book, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less, is all about living according to priorities rather than trying to do everything. If you think about it, it makes sense that priorities are central to effectiveness. If you have a choice between a low-value task and a high-value task, choosing the high-value task will make you more effective by definition, for it's the thing that will bring about greater and more meaningful results. If you practice prioritizing day after day, over time, you will have developed an ongoing pattern of effectiveness. Nonetheless, and this is a huge reason we get stuck, most of us don't truly set priorities. For years, I didn't, at least not consistently in an ongoing, disciplined way. And the reason I didn't set priorities was because I didn't understand why doing so was truly necessary. I think that's the same reason most people don't set priorities. We therefore need to look at why setting priorities is not simply a nice idea, but is absolutely essential to effectiveness and getting unstuck from the trap of constantly being busy but unproductive. Of doing an awful lot of things, feeling spread way too thin and yet getting nowhere. That's a really bad type of being stuck. And setting priorities is the answer. Why are priorities the key to effectiveness? So, why is setting priorities unavoidable for those who want to be unstuck and effective? The reason I initially didn't think priorities were necessary is simple. I thought I could do the high-value tasks and the low-value tasks as well. I didn't see a high-value choice and low-value choice. I didn't think there was a need to choose at all. But the lower value tasks weren't just sitting there harmlessly. They stole from my ability to do higher value tasks. So that's why we need to set priorities. It's not simply that tasks are not of equal value. It's that there are limits on what you can do. And to spend time on lower value tasks is not to spend that time on higher value tasks. And therefore, by definition, you will be less effective. Conversely, if you choose to spend your time on higher value tasks instead of lower value tasks, then you are onto something. More specifically, Peter Drucker gives two fundamental reasons why we have to prioritize. Let's take a look at his quote again. If there is any secret of effectiveness, it is concentration. Effective executives do first things first, and they do one thing at a time. Look at how he defines concentration. Doing one thing at a time, and making sure that the one thing you do is a first thing. There is the concept of prioritizing. Doing a very important thing, a first thing, and doing that one thing only, one thing at a time. By saying effective people do one thing at a time, Drucker isn't chiefly speaking against multitasking during the day, such as checking text messages while writing a report, though he would have much to say against that. Rather, he is speaking of high-level priorities, of how many large projects and responsibilities you have going on at once. He's saying that you have to do only one of those at a time. Why? The first reason is because of the nature of work itself. Drucker writes that there are always more important contributions to make than there is time available to make them. In other words, no matter how well you manage your time, you will always have more to do than you can accomplish. You will always have a time deficit. So you have to focus, concentrate, exclude, prioritize. The second reason for doing one thing at a time is because of human nature. We simply do not have the capacity to focus on more than two things at once. Some people do better work with two tasks in parallel because doing two projects provides a change of pace. But few people, Drucker notes, can perform with excellence three major tasks simultaneously. Drucker points out that the only known exception to this is Mozart. The other great composers, such as Bach, Handel, and others, composed only one major work at a time. They began the next only when they had finished their current one or had stopped work on it for a time. If you try to do three or more large tasks at once, you will never have the minimum time quantity for any of them, because important work requires continuous chunks of time. Having the same amount of time totaled up through smaller chunks does not work, because there are some things that cannot happen unless at least 2 hours are given to them at once. Focusing on everything scatters your powers, and so you get less done, even though you are trying to do more. What the latest research shows. The latest research confirms what we have seen. I really enjoy Charles Duhigg's Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business, because he looks deeply at what science shows us about productivity. In his chapter on focus, he discusses a study of the most productive people at a mid-sized recruiting firm. One of the things that stood out in the study was that the most productive workers worked on far fewer projects than the others. This is surprising, because you would expect them to be working on more projects at once, thus making them more productive, doing more faster. Instead, the most productive workers tended to have only 5 projects at once, whereas the others tended to have 10 or 12 at once. Nonetheless, the employees with more projects at once had a lower profit rate than the superstars, who were more careful about how they invested their time. Further, the more productive workers weren't choosing easy projects, projects that only leveraged existing skills and that they could do really fast. Instead, they chose projects that demanded that they learn new abilities and develop new networks. That's why the superstars worked only on 5 projects at a time. Meeting new people and learning new skills takes a lot of additional hours. In other words, they choose fewer projects so that they could do them better. And this showed up in the company's bottom line. By prioritizing, they made a bigger impact. the consequences of not setting priorities. And so we have seen why, without setting priorities, you ultimately get stuck. You get stuck because you become busy, but not productive. You are busy because you are doing so many things, but you aren't productive because you are making a millimeter of progress in a million directions, and you are majoring on minor things. Instead, you should get more done by doing fewer things of higher impact than by doing more things of lower value. And so, you need to stop doing some things and start spending more time on the few activities that can really make a difference in your life. As McEwen says so well, only once you give yourself permission to stop trying to do it all, to stop saying yes to everyone, can you make your highest contribution toward the things that really matter. How you really stick to this. Beyond priorities to posteriorities. Because of the centrality of priorities, we might think that once we set priorities, that is enough. Unfortunately, that is not the case. Our priority decisions will be challenged. The environment, and sometimes our own tendencies, will constantly try to pull us away from our priorities. This means that the job, however, is not to set priorities. That is easy. Everybody can do it. The reason why so few executives concentrate is the difficulty of setting posteriorities. That is, deciding what tasks not to tackle, and of sticking to the decision. And so, setting priorities must be complemented with the flip side of the coin, and the real challenge, setting posteriorities. That is, how you stay with your priority decisions. You say no to things outside of them instead of doing a little of everything. That is why we can see that the core principle of effectiveness is, in a sense, exclusion. For it is by excluding things that you are able to stick with your priority decisions. And then, within your priority decisions, you fully commit and give them all the resources they need to thrive. You don't skimp once you have taken something on as a priority. Exclusion is as important as selection. Indeed, they imply each other. For to focus on the one main thing means that you do not do the things that are outside of its scope. Why do most people not set posteriorities? First, it is risky, because what you postpone often ends up being abandoned altogether. Second, it is unpleasant, because every posteriority is somebody else's top priority. And so we often try to hedge by trying to do just a little bit of everything else as well. This makes everyone happy, but nothing whatever gets done. The result of radical exclusion. What is the result of concentration? You will get more done, and faster. As Drucker notes, concentration is necessary precisely because the executive faces so many tasks clamoring to be done. For doing one thing at a time means doing it fast. The more one can concentrate time, effort, and resources, the greater the number and diversity of tasks one can actually perform. On the other hand, you can't be successful when you splinter your resources among too many initiatives. And so excluding doesn't result in getting less done. By doing the first thing all the way to completion and then moving on to the next first thing, you build a large chain of progress that accomplishes far more of the things you want to do than if you tried to do them all at once. How to determine your priorities. Now, how do we determine our priorities? There are a few principles and a process you can use. But first, an important question. How many priorities? To choose our priorities, we need to know how many to choose, and we have already seen the answer before. Drucker's observation has proven true in my experience. Most of us can only effectively do, at most, two large things at once. Choosing one major responsibility area of your job and one major goal at a time is what it means to concentrate at the level of priorities. This may sound very risky, and even unrealistic, at first. However, note that this does not mean that these two things are the only things you are doing. Remember how in Chapter 11 we sought to identify 15 hours a week for top priority tasks? That's about the amount of time we consolidated, because that's the amount we can realistically expect to have full control over in our jobs. So, it is in 15 hours a week that you work exclusively on your two top priorities. With the rest of your time, you will be doing other things, many things, so other things will get done. In Duhigg's example, the effective people tended to have 5 projects. They were still limited. They weren't trying to do 15 like the others. But having 5 projects certainly does sound like having more than 2 priorities. They were able to do 5 projects, however, because they were doing their 2 top priorities in specified 15 hours of priority time. So, in sum, I am assuming that you aren't able to put all 40 or however many hours of your work week under your control, but that about 25 hours a week are devoted to other things. Then, you devote the 15 hours a week that are under your control to 1 or 2 large priorities. Principles for choosing priorities. Your priorities are the things through which you can make the greatest contribution. Thus, to determine your priorities means to determine where your highest points of contribution are. Along with your strengths, there are some principles that can help you identify your priorities. No one has surpassed the principles Drucker articulated for choosing priorities. 1. Pick the future against the past. 2. Focus on opportunity rather than problem. 3. Choose your own direction rather than climb on the bandwagon. 4. Aim high for something that will make a difference rather than something that is safe and easy to do. The process for determining priorities. Explore. The key to making good priority decisions is to first explore and evaluate a broad set of options before committing to any. Because you are going to commit and go big on only the vital few ideas or activities, you need to explore more options than most people do, who do not prioritize, so that you will be able to pick the right one. In Essentialism, McEwen outlines 5 things that assist this step of exploration: allowing space to think, taking time to observe, making time to play, getting enough sleep, and then applying highly selective criteria. While many people might see these things as low priorities or luxuries, they are actually essential because they enable your capacity to make good choices. We saw earlier that central to true productivity is valuing the development of productive capacity as well as direct results themselves, and that's what these activities do. As McEwen says, essentialists spend as much time as possible exploring, listening, debating, questioning, and thinking. But their exploration is not an end in itself. The purpose of the exploration is to discern the vital few from the trivial many. This is something, of course, that needs to have taken place over a period of time, before you get to this point. Identify the categories of your job. For each of your roles, you can identify the main responsibilities. You need to do that to have a full picture. Then, you need to determine the most important responsibilities and slot them into your calendar in the time you've consolidated. Recall your goals. Your priorities need to derive from and reflect your goals, so make sure to review your goals. Note, you may also find that you have too many goals. Select 2 priorities. Now it's time to select. You have the big picture. Now, apply radical selection and determine the top 2 large things that will make the biggest difference. Exclude everything else. Then, let the other stuff go. One way to help identify these things and feel good about letting them go is to ask, if we didn't already do this, would we go into this now? One of the big reasons we don't get moving on our priorities is because we are overloaded with what Drucker calls the tasks of yesterday. Many of these programs and activities have outlived their useful life and have ceased to be productive. And so one of the biggest time wasters are old tasks you keep doing just because you are already doing them. What to do with your priorities? To translate your priorities into action, you need to record them in a place that enables you to see them and to see them in the context of the big picture. To do this, I recommend creating a time leverage chart. Creating a time leverage chart. A time leverage chart has four simple columns. From left to right, they include the following. 1. The 5 to 7 responsibility areas of your job and top current goal. 2. A brief statement of what success looks like in that area. 3. The percentage of your time required to reach your goal, stated also in terms of hours. 4. The key activities for making your goal happen. For readers of What's Best Next, this is similar to the role map I outlined in Chapter 13. But it extends the concept further because it contains time estimates that allow you to see the responsibilities and tasks for your work in relation to their time commitments. Put your two priorities, I recommend one responsibility area, and then your current goal for the second, in bold. Now, it's time to allocate your time to them. You want to allocate 40% of your time to them. For our purposes here, I will assume a 40-hour work week. This means 16 hours. Does this mean that 24 hours go to the other categories? If so, it seems that this can easily undo your priority focus. Instead, while the work week is 40 hours, allocate only 30 hours worth to leave room for flexibility. That means allocating 14 hours between the other categories. Now you have a picture of your two priorities in the context of the whole, with a specific time allocation. Creating a time map. A time leverage chart is helpful, but it is not enough. You also need to translate your priorities into your schedule. Actually allocate your time to them. Doing this utilizes and builds on the concept of a time map, which I discuss in Chapter 14 of What's Best Next, Setting Up Your Week. Specifically, having your priorities defined allows you to have a more specific, targeted, and accurate time map. Slot your priorities into specific time slots on your time map. This forces you to carve out the time for your priorities, rather than leaving them simply at the level of good intentions. I recommend a 3-hour uninterrupted block each day for your priorities. Note two things about that. First, I recommend spending time on your priorities each day. One time I did this by putting one of my priorities into my time map for once a week, every Monday night. I tried to do this priority in just 3 to 4 hours a week. I found that this was detrimental because every week I needed extra time to clear the cobwebs and remember where I was. This project was also a lot more vulnerable to being skipped since it only had one slot a week. By having your priorities in your schedule each day, it isn't as big of a deal if one block has to be skipped, and you won't have to spend as much time remembering where you were and getting ramped back up, since it will have only been since the previous day that you last worked on it. Progressing with your priorities. In the way I am defining them here, your priorities are big projects that you are completing. And so your priorities will be continually changing as each project is completed. You progress with your priorities by doing one, in this case two, at a time. Focus on the priority until it's done, and then do the next, then the next. That's how you get that thing done and a lot of other things done as well. Each time you complete a priority, instead of simply going on to the next one you've been wanting to get to, reevaluate because circumstances change. Progressing in this manner should help to allay the fear that concentrating on one thing will mean that the other things won't get done at all. Sometimes that happens. But in general, focusing on one thing at a time is the only way to get many things done. Concentrating enables you to do more and do it better. Two examples. We will conclude with two examples to crystallize this concept. When Harry S. Truman took over as president, he realized that his top priority had to be foreign affairs, so he organized his day around this priority. The start of his day consisted of tutorials on foreign policy from his Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. What was the result? He became one of the most effective U.S. presidents in foreign affairs we have ever seen. Truman's practice is an example of what I mean by acting on the basis of priorities. Organizing your time around your top one or two responsibilities or initiatives and making them the cornerstone of your calendar. Peter Drucker tells the story of the CEO of a pharmaceutical company who accomplished more than any CEO he had ever known. The company was small and in one country when this man became CEO. 11 years later, when he retired, it was a worldwide leader. To get it to that point, this man didn't try to do everything at once. Instead, he worked in three priority phases. Research direction for the first years to make the company strong. Then, building the company internationally. And then, working out what their strategy should be in light of the fast-happening changes in the healthcare industry. Drucker writes, "It is unusual for any one chief executive to do one task of such magnitude during his entire tenure. Yet this man did three, in addition to building a strong, well-staffed worldwide organization. He did this by single-minded concentration on one task at a time." This is an example of what I mean by setting priorities and doing them one at a time. By lending your entire focus to one or two priorities at a time, working on them until they are completed, and then moving on to the next, you accomplish many things, often very important and difficult things that you could not have accomplished otherwise, things that count, make a difference, and move the world forward. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. It is not enough to decide what you will do. To truly make those things happen, you need to decide what you won't do. Exercise. Create a stop doing list. Chapter 13. Deep Work, Part 1. The New Superpower of Knowledge Work. Introducing the new superpower of the knowledge economy. While the link between attention and excellence remains hidden most of the time, it ripples through almost everything we seek to accomplish. Daniel Goleman. Peter Drucker said, "If there's one secret of effectiveness, it is concentration." Concentration means focus. As we've seen, we first need to focus our time because the most important work requires large, continuous stretches of time. Then we need to focus our tasks because not everything is going to fit into our time. Now we are going to see how we need to focus our attention so we can work with the highest possible intensity on the tasks we've selected to do in the time we have. In other words, we don't just manage our time to maximize the amount of time spent on important tasks. We maximize the amount of time we can spend on important tasks in a state of high focus. Protecting our time is not enough. We also have to protect the mental focus to get things done, for we don't just have limited time. We have limited brain power. Because our cognitive capacity has limits, we need to make the most of our limited capacity by focusing it on the task at hand in a state of high concentration. This is called deep work, and it is the new superpower for the knowledge era. It is the opposite of being stuck because it is doing work in a state of flow. The state of flow, however, can be hard to get into. Sometimes it seems random and subject to unpredictable inspiration, delivering inconsistent results. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can bring the power of flow more under your control so that you can utilize it almost on command. This chapter is about how to get into the flow and bring it under your control so that you can utilize it as a regular approach to your work. It is about taking the time you've consolidated and maximizing your focus during that time so that you get better results in less time. Deep work is not only a superpower for getting more high-quality work done in less time. It will also make you stand out because most people can't engage in deep work. Unfortunately, there are also obstacles to engaging in deep work because the behaviors required to do deep work don't usually produce short-term rewards. To resist these obstacles, we need to understand in more detail what deep work really is, why it matters so much, and how to do it. And we need to understand just how different it is from how most people work. How do most people work? Many people confuse being busy with being productive. They think someone is productive if they are doing a lot of tasks, especially if they respond quickly to requests. Conversely, if someone is not responding quickly and tends to do fewer tasks, they are thought of as less productive. While I affirm the benefit of quick responses and accomplishing a lot, this way of thinking easily gets taken to the extreme. In some organizations, looking busy is nearly as important as getting great results. People walk fast, check their email while waiting for the elevator, and work late because they need to be seen as productive. And being seen as productive is as important to their job security as actually being productive. Further, now that we are constantly technologically connected, we have requests coming to us at all times and in all places, and more of them. We can easily come to think we are productive if we are responding in a timely manner to all of these texts and emails and phone calls because it feels productive. We are getting immediate feedback and results, it seems, and looks productive. But what if the behaviors involved in constant connectivity and looking productive actually undermine real productivity? If you feel worn out by this way of working, I have good news. You don't have to do it this way. And if you enjoy this way of working, I can see that not every aspect of it is bad. But I commend to you a more productive way that involves reversing your mindset from reactive work first to deep work first. Understanding the productivity equation. How does productivity happen? We can illustrate it through a simple equation that I first encountered in Cal Newport's excellent book for college students, How to Be a Straight A Student, and which he expounded on more fully in his more recent book, Deep Work. The productivity equation is this: high-quality work produced equals time spent times intensity of focus. The power of focused attention. We see here that a relationship exists between the time we spend and how focused we are. Most of us recognize this intuitively, and contemporary research is confirming it. For example, Daniel Goleman writes in Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence, "In very recent years, the science of attention has blossomed far beyond vigilance. That science tells us that these skills determine how well we perform any task. If they are stunted, we do poorly. If muscular, we can excel. Our very nimbleness in life depends on this subtle faculty. While the link between attention and excellence remains hidden most of the time, it ripples through almost everything we seek to accomplish. If you work with a low degree of focus, you will have to work a much longer time to get the same results. Conversely, if you work with a high degree of focus, you can do the same amount of work in much less time. Hence, if you want to get your projects and tasks done more quickly and with greater quality, then you need to work with greater focus. If desired, you can use the extra time you freed up to get more done, or do other things that enhance the quality of your work and quality of life. The flow state. To do things with greater focus is to do them in the flow state. The results of working in the flow state are not small. As the classic work on flow and getting into the zone says, a person who experiences flow in an activity will end up with a product that others will find more valuable. Flow is the opposite of being stuck. It is being totally absorbed in a task with everything moving as it should be. You feel alert, strong, and at the peak of your abilities, and the task feels almost effortless. Your sense of time disappears. You are working deeply and efficiently, and your work is highly fulfilling. You are in a state of full concentration and deep enjoyment. Flow stands in contrast to frazzle, which is a great description of what being stuck often feels like. Workers in a state of frazzle experience constant stress that overloads their nervous system with floods of cortisol and adrenaline. Their attention fixates on their worries, not their job. This emotional exhaustion can lead to burnout. Flow is the optimal brain state for getting work done well. It is marked by great neural harmony, a rich, well-timed interconnection among diverse brain areas. In the state of flow, the brain is precisely attuned to the demands of the moment. Consequently, when our brains are in this zone, we are more likely to perform at our personal best, whatever our pursuit. More than this, flow is not simply a tool for getting more and better work done. It is an essential component of a fulfilling life. For when you are in a state of flow, the activity is its own reward. According to Csikszentmihalyi's research, the highest, most satisfying experiences in people's lives were when they were in flow. If we are going to live truly flourishing lives and not be stuck, then it is important not just for results, but for its own sake, that we experience flow in our work, since work is where we spend the bulk of our time. Yet, only 20% of people get in the zone at least once a day. How do you get in the zone? The flow state does not have to be left to chance. You can have control over it and make use of it every day. How do you get into the zone or a state of flow? There are two chief conditions for getting into the zone. A challenge that is just right for your skills. Challenge beyond skill is too hard, stress and anxiety rather than in the zone. Challenge matches skill, the zone. Challenge beneath skill, too easy, bored, and unfulfilled. The core idea is that the state of flow happens when we are involved in challenges that are neither too difficult nor too simple. It is a just manageable demand on our skills. When a task is too difficult, you get anxious. When it is too easy, you get bored. But when the task is a just right challenge, just slightly beyond your ability so that it is a stretch, but not too much of a stretch, the result is full focus and a state of flow. Clear goals with immediate feedback. As Dan Pink writes, in flow, goals are clear. You have to reach the top of the mountain, hit the ball across the net, or mold the clay just right. Feedback is immediate. The mountaintop gets closer or farther. The ball sails in or out of bounds. The pot you're throwing comes out smooth or uneven. If the goal is not clear, you have confusion and not flow. Likewise, if you can't see progress happening, the sense of momentum that is such a part of flow does not materialize. Flow is common in sports because the goals are clear and players see results as they go. But the flow state isn't limited to sports. The highest performers in every area of life experience it. To move toward a state of flow in your work, define clearly what the specific goals are for the task you are doing, what success looks like, and set up the task in such a way that you can see your progress as it happens. In particular, this means observing what is working and isn't working in how you do the task, and making decisions to take actions that you think will improve things. See what effect those have and keep progressing in this way. Is getting in the zone enough? Getting in the zone is crucial for high performance, but it is not enough because, as Daniel Pink points out, the zone is about right now, whereas mastery requires sustained effort over time. And the effort required to gain mastery is not always going to be carried out in the zone. Grit, willingness to endure through hard tasks, fueled by passion, is essential to mastery. We see both of these aspects in Scripture. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, is the key verse of this book, and, interestingly, actually alludes to getting in the zone. Paul tells us to be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. We see being in the zone in the word abounding, which includes being energized, flourishing, being wholehearted, and even in some measure, being in the zone. It is to be engaged, doing what we do from the heart and with full attention, not simply because we have to. Confer with Ephesians 6, verse 6. This is a crucial part of what it means to be unstuck, to be motivated, engaged, and making progress with joy on the right goals. God wants us to experience this abounding. Yet, note that Paul describes what we do as labor, for he continues, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. As one commentator points out, Paul's use of this word calls attention to the fact that some of the things we do will be burdensome. They will be difficult, highly challenging, even arduous, and likely not carried out in the zone. So while the scriptures affirm the importance of what modern research has classified as flow, just like that same research, they also recognize that not all of our work will be carried out in that state. Yet, what the scriptures do affirm without reservation is being wholehearted in our work, giving it our full effort. And that brings us back to the issue of focus. That is, full attention. Focus often brings us into the zone, but it is also possible when we are not in the zone. It leads us to the broader concept of how to make the most of the time we've consolidated to work on our priority tasks by harnessing the power of our full attention. This is a concept Cal Newport has labeled deep work, and it is rapidly becoming an essential operational style. Deep work. Deep work is the practice of focusing without distraction on a cognitively demanding task. Or, as Newport puts it in a bit more detail, deep work is when you perform professional activities in a state of distraction-free concentration that push your cognitive capacities to their limit. Deep work, in other words, is right in line with what we have seen about the importance of consolidating your time. Instead of working in a way that allows for constant interruptions and engages our attention at a partial level, we focus entirely and without distraction on the work that we are doing for an extended period of time. We work fully while we are working, rather than engaging in pseudo-work where we are dividing our attention between the task at hand and interruptions that come our way, or distractions such as social media. We give uninterrupted, entirely focused concentration to cognitively demanding tasks. Deep work is highly valuable because these efforts create new value, improve your skill, and are hard to replicate. Deep work includes deliberately harnessing the benefits of flow in your work life by making it a regular practice. Yet you also continue your focus and concentration even when you are not in a state of flow. The opposite of deep work is shallow work. Non-cognitively demanding, logistical-style tasks often performed while distracted. These efforts tend to not create much new value in the world and are easy to replicate. The unfortunate thing is that many of us operate in a state of shallow work most of the time, and our environment is ever more pressuring us in this direction. Deep work is the way to apply the productivity equation most effectively to your work. It means giving total focus to your work so that you can therefore get more done in less time, rather than working in a less focused way that therefore takes more time. How do you get into the state of deep work? We have already seen a bit about how to get into the zone. The other thing we need to know is how to fit deep work into your schedule. That's the next chapter. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. High quality work produced equals time spent times intensity of focus. So to get more done in less time, increase your focus by using deep work. Exercise. Reflect on these questions. 1. When is the last time you recall engaging in deep work? 2. How did you feel? 3. What are some ways you could create more time for deep work in your schedule? Chapter 14. Deep Work Part 2. Put deep work into your schedule and overcome distractions. How brain science helps us get in the zone and keep our focus. The ability to concentrate intensely is a skill that must be trained. Cal Newport. Cal Newport asks, once you accept that deep work is valuable, isn't it enough to just start doing more of it? The answer is no. The reason is that the environment and our own tendencies fight against doing more deep work. Consequently, just starting to do it won't work. You have to put strategies and mechanisms in place to make it a habit you stick with. You need to train yourself for deep work and build your capacity to do it. Newport writes, just as a basketball player making a free throw on a rival team's court has to train his body to perform despite the screaming crowd, creative minds must learn to train their attention and marshal their creative energies under the most chaotic circumstances. The good news is that it is possible to train yourself to be better at deep work. Here are 3 strategies that will enable you to build your capacity for deep work. Strategy 1. Put deep work into your schedule. You must protect time for deep work. If you don't put deep work into your schedule, it won't happen. But there isn't just one way to do this. Newport says, you need your own philosophy for integrating deep work into your professional life. There are 4 main approaches you can take to deep work, and you need to pick the one that is best suited to your preferences and your environment. Those who fear that deep work might mean working alone on individual tasks all day will find the 3rd and 4th approaches liberating and refreshing. Monk. The monk approach is the simplest and is also the rarest, the most radical, and the hardest to do. It is not for everyone. In this approach, you almost exclusively do deep work. You aren't totally cutting yourself off from the world, but activities other than deep work are batched into perhaps one day a month. This is for people whose professional success comes from doing just one thing exceptionally well, such as writing novels. Someone with this philosophy might say, all of my time and attention are spoken for several times over. Please do not ask for them. Bimodal. For those who cannot handle the monk approach, the bimodal approach allows you to integrate deep work with more ordinary activities through an approach that is analogous to taking retreats. You don't have to literally take a retreat. What you do is have a period of time, say a week or month, engaged in interactive give-and-take activities. Then you transition to a period of time, say a week or month, where you focus exclusively on deep work activities. In other words, you set aside clearly defined stretches for deep pursuits, and then the rest of the time you are open to everything else. This is the approach taken by Swiss psychiatrist and psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who ran a busy practice seeing patients. He would often retreat to his cabin in the woods to focus on writing. This approach works well for those who have to, and want to, have open time to respond to what comes their way, without letting that eliminate their ability to engage in deep work. As Newport summarizes this approach in relation to Jung, he says, Jung needed his clinical practice to pay the bills, and the Zurich coffee house scene to stimulate his thinking. His life in Zurich was much like the hyper-connected digital age knowledge worker. But his retreats to write and refine his thinking enabled him to produce the articles and books needed to establish his analytical psychology school of thought.